It's Taco Salad Thursday, so you should run down and get taco salad.
The Senate Committee on Finance will reconvene, and we have on the agenda, first up, Senator Michelle with Senate File 887. Senator Michelle, do you want to start out by explaining your bill, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and I have with me Senate Counsel and Senate Fiscal to help, depending on how much depth and detail you want to get into. My opening remarks, Madam Chair and members, would be that well, this is not the biggest bill that is you're going to see in the next week here, and that most of the funds and most of the activities within the state agencies that are within the jurisdiction of this of the Jobs Committee, 90% of that is federal money. 90% of that are outside the general fund. So we have a very small segment of the pie that we're working with when we're looking at the general fund. The general fund target for this budget, Madam Chair, was $103.2 million. And so we needed to find $65 million from the base of $168.2 million. So, Madam Chair, the bulk of the budget work that we have done involves really three agencies. The Department of Employment and Economic Development, DEED, the Department of Labor and Industry, and then the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. So, Madam Chair, let me just note a couple things at the outset. I don't know if we want to call them highlights, but especially for purposes of this committee. So there is a transfer or a loan from the IRRB, that's a large piece of this budget. In the way of reform, Madam Chair, we have put together a new structure for how to handle these workforce development grants, which have up till now been pass-throughs and direct appropriations to various programs. And so somewhere within your packets, Madam Chair, is a legislative auditor's report from last year, and also DEED's response to that legislative auditor's report. So it's a packet that says, on the front page, it says Positively Minnesota at the top. So we use that to help structure a new way to fund and monitor and oversee these workforce development grants. So that involves some budget reductions over on the DEED, within the DEED department. And we also, Madam Chair, have some new ideas for how to handle the Minnesota Trade Office. And consistent with some earlier remarks from the governor during the campaign, our suggestion is that we move the Minnesota Trade Office into the governor's office and find a new public-private partnership to fund and move on with those activities to promote trade in Minnesota. So, Madam Chair, those are that's a quick way to cover the how we got to $103.2 million, our target. Again, I have both policy and fiscal experts here. If you'd prefer one of them to go through the bill in any more specific way or through the spreadsheet, I'd leave that to your discretion, Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle, yes, I think we would like to run through the spreadsheet. We're very interested in anything financial.
Well, Madam Chair, I would ask Mr. Dave Jensen to start us through that then.
Madam Chairman and members, I'm Dave Jensen, the fiscal analyst for the Jobs and Economic Growth Committee. You have a spreadsheet before you, kind of a standard layout, starting with the base and the governor's changes and the Senate changes and then the totals. Let's start on the left-hand side with line 11 and 12. The governor had suggested some increases for the Minnesota Investment Fund. Because of the shortage of money, the committee suggested that they use the revolving loan fund and some federal dollars for that effort. Line 14 is the reduction for the Minnesota Trade Office that the chairman explained. Line 15 through 19, these are general fund monies that will be available on a competitive basis. And these basically go out to pass-through grants that are business-related. You can see those four, and then there's one more included. It's on the second page, and I'll mention that. Line 21 through 25 is the start of the consolidation for the competitive grant program from the Workforce Development Fund, which is basically for training purposes. You can see there's three pass-throughs there that will be part of the total. Madam Chair, on line 30, the petroleum tank release cleanup, there was a proposal to extend the fee or the tax in the second fiscal year. The committee did not accept that extension of the tax. Madam Chair, on page 2, line 50 is the advocating change together. They'll be part of the business pass-through competitive grant process. Madam Chair, on lines 51 through 55 are some base items that very small cuts on only one item. Line 58 and 57, there was additional spending recommended for the rehab services for the state and state services for the blind. The committee declined to increase the state spending in this budget. Line 58 through 64, also part of the general fund consolidation for pass-through grants. These five agencies are training, so they'll be kind of part of the whole workforce development training consolidation for competitive grants. Line 66 through 684 is most of the pass-through grants for training purposes. Those are all from the Workforce Development Fund. Some of these are items or activities that the department actually operates. The proposal is to have those also compete for the training dollars. Madam Chairman, on the next page, line 101, the committee makes a transfer of $6,006,000 to the Workforce Development Fund to increase the spending for the training effort. Line 109 is just the general support for deed, and there's a slight reduction there. Lines 21, 121, 122, and 123 is the summary of the proposal for competitive grants. This total includes deed and the Labor and Industry Department. And you can see that there is a total of about $91 million that comes into the fund. For cost savings purposes, there's about a 10% reduction. And that leaves about $82 million training dollars for the next biennium. Madam Chairman, members, on page 4, line 134 is the Science and Technology Authority. That's a new authority that was established in the 2010 legislative session, and the base funding is recommended there. The Housing Finance Agency, the committee accepted the governor's recommendation for a reduction of about $6 million. The governor had proposed spending more money on the Housing Trust Fund. It's line 152. And that would be for additional rental assistance for basically for families. The committee did not accept the governor's new spending. Madam Chair, the rest of that page is just showing the governor and Senate changes, and that they are all the same. Madam Chairman, on page 5, line 182, you'll see the governor had was a net cut of $4 million. The Senate has a net cut of $6 million. Madam Chairman, for the smaller boards and commissions, the accountancy board, there is a small increase of $150,000 in the governor and the Senate, and that's to improve the licensing system for all the people that, who are accountants or all those that are engineers, surveyors, landscapers, et cetera. That $150 or $300 is recovered through the licensing fee process. Madam Chair, line 202 used to be the Boxing Commission. It's now called the Combative Sports Commission, and that's being changed from a general fund appropriation to entirely supported by their own revenues. Chairman, on page 6, start the Labor and Industry Department. The recommendations are basically the same. On line 235, there's a fee increase. It's actually an extension of a surcharge on billing permits, and they've asked to extend that for additional revenue to the Code Consolidation Fund. Madam Chairman, on page 7, line 262, there is some workforce development money in labor and industry, and there's three programs there, and they will be part of the proposal for competitive grants from the Workforce Development Fund. Also, Madam Chair, on line 261, there was a small reduction to the general fund for labor standards in the Department of Labor and Industry of $86,000. Madam Chairman, members, on page 8 is the Mediation Services Board. There's no reduction. The Workers' Comp Board of Appeals, there's no reduction. And we have some money through the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation. There's no reduction to that. So, Madam Chairman, members, on line 304 is the total for the bill. You can see the governor proposes spending about $4 million more. The Senate is reducing the spending by about $11 million. So there's a change there or a swing in the numbers of over $14 million. Madam Chairman, members, on page 9, there's the general fund revenue that's it is recommended. We're transferring about 10% of the Workforce Development Fund from that fund to the general fund. The thought was there would be about 10% savings by consolidating and having competitive grants. Also from the IRRB, there's a transfer from their Northeast Minnesota Economic Protection Trust Fund of $45 million. The testimony we heard that the balance was over $100 million, and we have established a loan repayment schedule of 3 years, so it will recover that money fairly quickly. So, Madam Chairman, members, on line 350 and 351, you can see the $103 million target, and we're Chairman Michelle is right at zero, so he's met the target perfectly.
I don't know if you get credit for that, Madam Chair.
Well, you get bonus points if you have savings, actually.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, Senator Sullivan can know if he gets more money, though.
No.
He doesn't want the bonus points. He wants the money.
No more money available. Members, do you have questions for Mr. Jensen about the spreadsheet at all? Senator Michelle, maybe we could go then through part of the policy.
Okay.
I know that some of the terms of the new grant arrangements, we'd probably like to hear some additional details about how that will work, and maybe the IRRRB loan repayment, how that will work as well.
So, Madam Chair, why don't I ask Ms. Doyle to walk through and at least hit the highlights within the language of the bill that is in front of you.
Madam Chair and members, I am going to work off of the summary that was handed out to you. So Mr. Jensen went through the numbers, so I will concentrate on some of the language, but in the summary, numbers and totals are provided for the overall jobs and economic development appropriations. There's a total for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And then under business and community development, this is the area that provides funding for general business and community development activities of the department. And then also there's money from the remediation fund and from the general fund for the contaminated site cleanup and development grants. And finally, there is money that was provided through, on a pass-through basis to several business development organizations, and now this is going to be pooled into a business development competitive grant pilot program. And this is one of the pilot programs. This is a pilot program, but this is one competitive grant program, and then there'll be another one for the Job Skills Partnership Board. For the competitive grant pilot program, there is a reporting requirement that the Department of Employment and Economic Development get back to the legislature on the program parameters and criteria that they'll develop for this business development pilot program. So that's the language or requirement here in the rider language on page 3. Then continuing on to the workforce development area, this section appropriates money for general job skills partnership program activities. This area also appropriates money that was going to some training programs from the general fund, and then also approximately $41 million in each biennium for this competitive grant program. And Senator Michelle and Mr. Jensen discussed that a little bit, but in the language, it directs the program to be run under the statute that governs the Job Skills Partnership Board, and it turns it in and tries to turn it into a competitive grant program. It extends the funds to be available to training organizations, and that would include any political subdivision. There was some question whether or not City of St. Paul or Ramsey County would qualify, and this has tried to clarify that a little bit. This also has a reporting requirement that each year by January 15th that the department report back to the legislature on the number of grants that were given, the dollar amounts, and then some other required elements regarding how many people received training, the success, job placement, also individuals who were trained, such as statistics on data on minorities, youth, underemployed individuals, and public assistance recipients who received training from these dollars. Moving on, we also have appropriations to the Vocational Rehabilitation Program, to State Services for the Blind activities, to Centers for Independent Living, Extended Employment Services for persons with severe disabilities, and Employment Support Services to persons with mental illness. And Mr. Jensen, there's no cut to those programs at this point. Some language regarding the contingent account. There's also an appropriation for state-funded administration, and then in the next subdivision 5 is the transfers in section. This is a section that discusses the transfer from the Douglas J. Johnson Economic Protection Trust Fund in the amount of $45 million and provides for a repayment schedule of $15 million in years 2015 to 2017. And then there's also some language that reflects the 10% reduction in the transfer from the Workforce Development Fund for each year. Section 4 is the Science and Technology Authority, and again, these are funded. The authority is funded for both years of the biennium. Section 5 is funding for the Housing Finance Agency, and this is for the Challenge Program, the Housing Trust Fund, Rental Assistance for Mentally Ill, Family Homeless Prevention, Home Ownership Assistance Fund, Affordable Rental Investment Fund, Housing Rehabilitation, Home Ownership Education, and Capacity Building Grants. And these are all at the governor's level except for the Housing Trust Fund. That is different from its $1 million. Each year the biennium is $1 million less from the governor's recommendations. The next area of the appropriations is for the Department of Labor and Industry. And the one difference was some workforce development funds that were going to the Department of Labor and Industry are now included in the competitive grant pool. Moving on for, and then that also includes workers' compensation, labor standards and apprenticeship, and then general support for Department of Labor and Industry, and that those dollars are from the workers' compensation fund. The next agency under in this bill is the Bureau of Mediation Services, and also we're funding the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, the Board of Accountancy, Board of Architecture, Engineering, Land Surveying, Landscape Architecture, Geoscience, and Interior Design. And the Board of Accountancy and the Board of Architecture, Mr. Jensen mentioned that $150,000 of this is going for the e-licensing costs, and that's in the language in the bill. The Board of Cosmetologist Examiners, Board of Barber Examiners, and those are the agencies being funded in the bill, and those these are at the governor's recommend levels as well for those last agencies I mentioned. So that was the first article of the bill. The second article of the bill are some miscellaneous economic development provisions, and I'll just quickly go through that language as well. The first section is some language that is the result of this, the legislative auditor's recommendations regarding the pass-through grant programs. And this language is in the bill because there are some pass-through grant recipients that would still be subject to this. The recommendation was that the Department of Employment and Economic Development capture a 5% administrative and monitoring cost for monitoring these programs. The legislative auditor's report pointed out that for some of the programs, they weren't getting any funds for the monitoring process. So this language allows that to occur. The next subdivisions are Section 2 and 3 and 4 are from a Senator Metzen bill, and these make some changes that are technical changes to the Angel Tax Credit Program that was passed last year and changes the definition for intern for purposes of the Angel Tax Credit Program in Section 2. In Section 3, it changes the payment amount for the interns to 175% of the federal minimum wage. It also raises a threshold from $2 to $4 million for the qualified small businesses for certification under the Angel Tax Program. And Section 4 also makes a technical change to allow that only there have to be only three natural persons and for a business certified business to seek tax credit under the program. Section 5 of the bill is actually the statutory changes or some changes made to the statute for the Job Skills Partnership Program to try to turn it into this competitive grant program that I mentioned. And the changes, are subtle, I guess, trying to turn it into a competitive grant program. It limits the grants to $1 million per institution, and it adds consideration for training, job placement, and retention levels when making the grants. And this would be effective for grants made on or after July 1st of 2011. The last two sections of this article relate to the Combative Sports Commission turning into a self-sufficient organization, not receiving any more general funds. It increases their fees so that they will be self-sufficient now. Article 3 is mostly labor, Department of Labor and Industry, some technical changes regarding continuing education and some other licensing uniformity that is following some changes that were made last year to licensing provisions. So I don't know if you want me to go through all those. They're very technical relating to continuing education, but I do want to point out that there were a couple of bills that I believe you heard in your committee. One is from Senator DeCrieff. This was Senate File 634. This was also some Department of Labor and Industry technical changes, and those are in sections 1, 2, 7, 48, and 49 of this article. Let's see. They are sections, section 1. Let's see. We're starting on.
I don't know the page. They should be in section 1.
It's on page 18.
Rest of them, thank you.
And 19.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
And Madam Chair, I don't know if there's a specific question regarding the language, but it's article or sections 1 and 2. And section 1 makes a change for this independent contractor exemption, also regarding some penalties. Section 2 is just adding an enforcement section provision for the department. Let's see. And then it was section 7, 48, and 49. They're in the summary, but I mean, I can go through them if you need me to. The other bill that you also heard in this committee was Senate File 225 from Senator Peterson. This was the manufactured housing bill. This was also doing some cleanup work from manufactured housing changes that were done last year, and those are in sections 50 through 54 of the bill. It's at the way end of the bill. And I think other than those, than the technical provisions regarding continuing education and some other licensing changes, that is the contents of Article 3.
Madam Chair.
One question. What are the repealers?
The repealers, Madam Chair and members, those are also relating to the Department of Labor and Industry technical changes, but some definitions, for example, in 326B82, subdivision 4, that was the term coordinators replaced with sponsor. It's defined somewhere else. Subdivision 6 was deleting an obsolete definition of licensee, and then the last one, 326B.821, subdivision 3, is a continuing education requirement that's now being dealt with elsewhere. So they're not substantive.
Thank you very much. Do members have questions?
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Michelle?
If I may, I think it's worth spending a little more conversation on this new structure, this new framework for the workforce development program. So I just want to highlight two things for the committee. I know we don't have busloads of people coming up to the Capitol asking us to do what the legislative auditor recommended. You know, we don't have a loud group coming in and suggesting we should follow the OLA. But they've done some very good work. This is coming from a report from last year, Madam Chair. And so what I want to do is, again, you've got a packet with Positively Minnesota at the top. And I want to ask members to look at page 3 of that packet, which shows all these individual directly appropriated funds from the legislature to these programs. And so what we talked about in our committee this week, Madam Chair and members, was, you know, we could keep doing this. We could keep doing, you know, identifying each single program, giving them a line item, $750,000 here, $1 million there, And we could shave that amount to meet our target, or we could do what the legislative auditor had suggested, Madam Chair. And so now I'm going to ask you to flip back to page one. And here was a couple findings. You'll see them in the bullet points. The legislative auditor recommended that the legislature should not mandate grant recipients in law, but instead allow the selection of recipients through a competitive process administered by DEED. And then the second bullet there, DEED should more consistently monitor recipients of legislative appropriations and develop an equitable way of funding its monitoring activities. Madam Chair, I think this there's a little bit of, in this bill and in this particular provision that gets the legislature, gets us a couple steps away from the past practice of what I would call earmarking. This is as close to what the state legislature has done in earmarking specific programs with specific amounts of money. We have ended up, members, with dozens of programs, good programs. You will know many of them. Job training, workforce development. But according to the legislative auditor and others, they've gotten away from us. And so what we want to do is give them some more structure and framework and also benchmark and measure how are these programs doing. The best programs, I would argue, could get more money, receive more funding through this new competitive kind of merit-based program. But admittedly, it's changing the way we do business. And I know there's some discomfort with how are we going to make this transition and how quick can we do it. And our committee is committed to continue to work on the making sure that's smooth, Madam Chair. But I would argue that this puts together a strong framework for these kind of programs going into the future. And it will provide policymakers like you with a way to measure how are these programs doing. So I thank you for giving me a few minutes just to highlight that some more, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Michelle, I have a couple questions. And the part that I'm curious about is how you're going to have a competitive grant program for what's likely to be, I don't know, for lack of a better phrase, apples and oranges. You know, how are you going to put summer jobs for kids up against, you know, workforce training for people with disabilities, up against the Inventors Congress, or something about floods? I saw $10 million for floods, and you know, Bio Business Alliance. They're just so hard to try to imagine how you could put together a framework that would accurately and fairly make one compete against another.
Senator Michelle?
Madam Chair, there's a couple ways to respond to that. I would first of all start with Senator Higgins. We already have that competition.
It's here. At this table.
It's here. And I would argue that we as policymakers don't really have the tools to determine, you know, you just went through that list. And whether you call it apples versus oranges or how do you measure each of those apples and each of those oranges, I think we need that. We need to develop this framework. So as you were going through that list, I was reminded, and I want to ask Mr. Jensen to give a little bit of an outline here, but we actually set up two separate again, we'll call it competitive bid programs within the language in front of you. So, as Mr. Jensen, if you could just describe, it's not one big pile; it's two.
Mr. Jensen,
Madam Chairman, members, there's two kind of pools. One of those is for the business-related pass-through grants, and one is for those that are training that get pass-through money. Training being, you know, for the individual to receive help in job training, soft skills, and maybe getting to work on time. That's the training part. The business is more like the Biobusiness Alliance, Metro Economic Development Association, Minnesota Inventors Congress, Women Ventures. they would be in this business pool because they're more business-related, trying to create businesses, get started with a business, start up businesses. And so we see a difference between those two groups, and there's a difference in the funding. The training basically is coming from the Workforce Development Fund, which comes through the Job Skills Partnership Board. And the other part is general fund money that's available to the department.
And then, Madam Chair, just as a final follow-up to Senator Higgins' question, so if you might want to take a look at the language, specific language on pages 3 and 4, but the idea here is not to just take the funds and throw them at an agency. We need to, and whether it's the language on pages 3 and 4 and in other places, we need to give them some definition, how to run this program, the kind of benchmarks and measurements that we're interested, the kind of programs we want them to prioritize. That absolutely is a legislative function. And so I don't know if that'll totally allay your concern, Senator Higgins, but it's at least a start.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, thank you. So a couple of more questions. Ordinarily, they would be, if they were included in this bill, they would be eligible for funds July 1st. And now, how soon do you think the funding would get out to the organizations now through this new process?
Senator Michelle?
We're moving fast, Senator Higgins.
And that would be?
We need to get this program up and running this summer.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, the other question I had is the commission is supposed to report to the legislature by October 1st. I'm just wondering whether you think we'll still be here at that point. Or
well, and
Michelle.
Madam Chair, and I know Senator Higgins, I thank her for making me laugh a little bit this afternoon, but we did take a lot of testimony on, well, are you taking away some stability? You know, there are some recipients of this funding that would say, well, we've been able to come to the legislature budget after budget, and this is now stable funding. And one of the responses we had was, well, if you look at the current state budget, you look at our budgets over the next couple of our forecasted budgets for the next couple biennium, I don't know how we as policymakers can look at any of these folks and say, yes, we are the place to come for stable funding. We have deficits that stretch out forever. So, yes, this is a change. And no, I don't think we'll be here on October 1st.
Madam Chair, just one last question. So I'm still trying to wrap my heads around my head around this. One of the projects that's in my district that usually gets funding is summer jobs for Minneapolis kids. School gets out in June, and the kids will be looking for jobs. And I know that Minneapolis does a great job in getting a lot of matching funds from a lot of the businesses in Minneapolis and jobs that the kids can go work at. But if this money isn't coming in time for the summer jobs this summer, that's a real problem. So I'm wondering whether you had conversations about that.
But two pieces. Yes, we heard from both, Madam Chair, we heard from both a Minneapolis summer program and also a St. Paul, and had some testimony actually from youth, which was fun to have in committee. I guess two thoughts on that. One is, I think that should, the fact that we have summer youth programs should be another motivation for all the members in this room and the rest of the 67 in the state Senate to get our work done in May and not stretch into the summer because people are waiting for our decisions. And secondly, I wanted to note, and maybe Ms. Doyle can help me with Senator Higgins here on, there's a rolling grant process, okay? So it's not just, this doesn't just happen one time and then all the decisions would be made. There's a rolling grant process. Am I describing that as well as you'd like me to, Ms. Doyle?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, as I looked at the Job Skills Partnership Board, you know, it's already in place. There's a board there already. And as I looked at their meeting minutes and there is a rolling grant process that's already in place, and they look at grant applications throughout the year. So I don't, that, to Mr. Senator Michelle's point, that I don't think it's just a July 1 type of grant process.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, is there a special implementation date of this change, or is it the regular one that August 1st that it goes into effect? What's the effective date? I couldn't find it in the bill, other than in the last section there was an effective date for that last section for January 1st, 2012. But is there effective dates that are standard for these appropriations and changes?
July 1st.
Is it the beginning of the next fiscal year?
Madam Chairman, members, yes, it's the regular fiscal year when this appropriation would be effective.
Thank you.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Michelle, Senator Higgins pointed out that October 1st, 2011, and just to remind you that Senator Rest and Senator Betzold, our former colleague, always felt very strongly to change those dates so that we would have dates when reports are due when we're actually there, so that there's somebody to report to. That's up to you whether you want to make that change or not. I just want to mention that. And then I had a question. With regard to the grant program, you did fund the base amount for the Science and Technology Authority, which I thank you for. I'm really pleased that you put that in the bill. But we also put forward a proposal to use tax increment financing in a pretty innovative way to fund startups in this area. So I know the tax bill is being put together now, and I hadn't gotten my request for a hearing to this point in the tax committee. It was referred to the tax committee. Is there, if that doesn't happen, would they, you know, would you see this grant program as being a place where the authority would apply to? Or do you think that there still may be the possibility to fund that part of the Science and Technology Authority request yet this session?
Could help.
Mr. Jensen?
Chairman, Senator Bonner, yes, I think the bill that you're proposing would help this new authority to have money to reallocate or spend.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. And Senator Michelle, do you have any sense of the prognosis for that proposal?
For the tax bill, Madam Chair? I do not.
Okay.
But we should talk some more.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I note that we have two amendments that I would consider both technical in nature. I know Senator Magnus has the language for those. I don't mean to interrupt any questions, but
Senator Magnus, would you like to offer those?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got the A16 amendment. Wait till the members get it. It's as Senator Michelle said, it's a technical amendment, basically clearing up some language here in the direction of funds. Well, I'll wait till the members have it before we go out.
Mr. Gustafson can explain it quickly.
Madam Chair, members, this is an amendment that fiscal staff was interested in having changed in this bill to clarify the distinction between a direct appropriation in this article versus things that are statutorily appropriated elsewhere in Minnesota law. And so this simply changes the point of the rider in referencing the statutory appropriations is really for information purposes. And so the amendment changes the phrasing to clarify that it is simply an estimate of what exists in other provisions of statute and is not separately appropriating the $41 million that's referenced here.
Are there any questions about the amendment? If not, all in favor of the amendment, of the A16 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I also have the A-17 amendment.
Really?
We're right here close in the same section, members.
I've got that one to offer, too. Are they the same one?
Oh, no. Let me do mine first, and then we'll see if it passes. And maybe no, I'm just kidding, Senator Olson. The A-17 amendment clears up some language again and adds some funding here. That's a clarification of funding for the article here dealing with the unemployment program for the severely disabled. And my amendment members would state after the word fund on line 5.9 to insert and $6,147,000 each year is from the Workforce Development Fund. We need to have that language in there to take that funding from that, take the money from that fund to support the unemployment program for the severely disabled, as we were talked about earlier. I would ask members to approve that motion.
Senator Olson?
If I could add to that, I think it is that's a provision that is, I believe, to be inappropriately placed in the competitive grant program, because it's actually not a job training. It's an extended employment, Senator Magnus, for the stated, it's for the severely disabled, and it's already a pay-for-performance. They're only paid for the hours that their clients work. And they're doing work that is for private employers, so the wages that the clients are receiving are actually from private sources. And so it doesn't function very well in a competitive grant program. I've visited, I think some of these are around the state. Opportunity Partners is the one I'm most familiar with. And so I think that's why it should not be in the competitive grant. This brings it back, and if you can look on your spreadsheet, it's the line 71, extended employment, and it would move it back up somewhere in the either by independent living services or rehab services, probably in a separate line. It also is reduced by the 10%, so it is revenue neutral.
Thank you for that explanation. Senator Goodwin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wonder if you could tell me, maybe one of the fiscal analysts, what this money that's being transferred would otherwise be used for.
Mr. Jensen, do you want to explain?
Madam Chairman, members, the amount that's being transferred is 10% less than what you see on the sheet for the workforce development. The committee was convinced that there should be some cost savings on these programs also. So there was a 10% reduction, and that was transferred to the general fund.
Madam Chair.
I think it was rolled into the competitive grant pool, but it's being taken out of there.
Taken out of the competitive grant pool.
So that's where it's coming from right now.
Thank you.
And Senator Higgins.
And Madam Chair, I'm trying, I guess maybe the first question to ask is the Workforce Development Fund healthy? It looks like on line 356, we're transferring money into that fund from the UI Contingency Fund, which makes me wonder if taking $6 million back out of it is in conflict with putting that $6 million into it.
Mr. Jensen.
Chairman, members, in the UI contingent fund, there was a sufficient balance, and the governor recommended changing from the UI contingent fund to the workforce development fund within the department. And the proposal accepts that transfer of $6.6 million. And after that, then this new proposal came along or is in place. And the idea was to take 10% savings off the entire fund.
Senator Michelle.
And Madam Chair, and directly to Senator Higgins' question. So, Senator Higgins, there's an attempt in this bill to keep this funding level. So the Workforce Development Fund that you just brought up. So the base, the 12-13 base for the Workforce Development Fund, I have here is $83.03 million. After the changes in the bill, So from 83.03, we're at 82.47. So overall, it's less than a 1% reduction in the Workforce Development Fund.
But Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins?
Senator Michelle, aren't we doing a whole bunch of competitive grants out of the Workforce Development Fund?
Senator Michelle?
And Mr. Jensen, can you explain? So we're transferring some in and we're transferring some out.
And that's why you only go down a million.
That fair way to say?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct. And I think Mr. Chairman has explained, Madam Chairman, that the competition is moving from the legislature to the Job Skills Partnership Board and the Department of Employment and Economic Development.
Okay, we're on the A-17 amendment. Are there any further questions about it? If not, all in favor of the A-17 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Cohen.
I don't know if Mr. Michelle had any other amendments he was offering, but I had a couple of questions if I could.
I think the author's done offering amendments, so Senator Cohen, you may ask questions.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Mr. Michelle, something I forgot to ask in committee the other day or yesterday. Can you just explain why sections roughly 9 to 25 are in the bill?
Senator Michelle?
Through 25.
Article 3?
Pardon?
Article 3?
Starting.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, is there a specific page number you want us to start at here?
Article 3?
23. Okay, so this is the
plumbing. Yes.
This is the cloud cream.
And Madam Chair, Sarah Michelle, in particular, I'd like to learn what this has to do with the finance bill.
Madam Chair, the short answer for is this Peterson's bill? No. Okay. A couple short answers for Senator Cohen. So, starting on page 23, that is. Legislation that's been brought to us by the Department of Labor and Industry, and it was also included in the governor's budget bill.
The plumbing stuff?
And Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, is that true of the rest of it? I think, well, Madam Chair, let me just kind of cut to the chase. I apologize. I shouldn't kind of go through this routine. The issue is, and it's not that Madam Chair, Senator Michelle's an offender. Probably to the contrary, he's probably less of an offender than we've been in the past number of years. The question is, how much policy do you want in these finance bills that has nothing to do with finance issues? And again, I want to make it clear, this is not something that, Madam Chair, we're going to have some discussion of issues that I think are unique to this particular Senate. This is not an issue that's unique to this particular year of the state Senate. And as I said, I think Senator Michelle's bill is actually cleaner in that regard than bills we've had in the past. Madam Chair, you know from sitting on this committee over the years that that's a debate that we often have as to how much policy you put in a bill. We know that it's not a rule as such, but we know that that is often breached. Maybe the question might be better directed not to Sarah Michelle, but maybe to yourself, Madam Chair, because this is the first time I think we have some provisions that, at least to my way of reading them, are not finance-driven as to what your perspective is on what we ought to be doing with these bills.
Well, Senator Cohen, I know in the past we've had a lot of policy and finance bills, and this year with the lack of separation of finance and policy committees, I expect that there probably will be a fair amount of policy in the bills because the committee's jurisdiction is not as defined as it has been in the past. And so I expect that we will see a fair amount of policy, much like we have in the past.
Madam Chair,
Senator,
if I could dangerously interject myself between Senators Cohen and Roebling. No attempt here, Senator Cohen, and I appreciate you already indicating that. No attempt here to pull any fast one. This was heard in our committee. I believe you were there. No opposition. This is cleanup language from the department. It does involve some licensing. And so it, I guess you could, I think you could argue with a straight face that it fits in a budget bill. It also was in the governor's budget language. And so we have made attempts beyond this language to try to meet the governor. And so it was within that spirit that this language was included.
Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, my response to that is I would argue it's irrelevant as to what the governor thinks or doesn't think as to what ought to be in a finance bill in that respect. However, I pull out a number of sections. I do think Senator Peterson's bill was not part of the governor's bill.
Stays in there.
Don't think
it
wasn't.
Madam Chair, I'm just being told, so Senator Peterson's bill was heard in finance, is what I'm told.
No. Madam Chair, I'm not disputing that. I was just drawing the distinction with what the governor had presented or not presented. Madam Chair, your explanation is semi-satisfactory. I'm trying to think what my adjective would be. To the extent that I understand you combine policy and finance. And we did some of the same, not to the extent that you've done that, Madam Chair, or the Senate majority has done that. We had the transportation division, which also had policy. I think we did that with higher education. I thought we were going a little bit too far down that road. And, Madam Chair, I'm not here to argue the structure of the Senate. That's your decision. But I do think that we ought to be careful about combining tons of policy in a finance bill. And again, I'll make it clear, Sarah Michelle has done that to a very limited extent, and more limited than most finance chairmen over the years. But then you end up with a bill that's just a pile of policy, because maybe you can't get it passed by the other body, so we'll go to a conference with the other body and try to get our policy in that fashion, or maybe we're going to try to figure out how to, work around the governor. I think for many substantive legislative reasons, it's bad to go down that road. And I think once you do, unless you offer some clear delineation, you'll find yourself potentially at some point regretting that. Maybe not during this session, but maybe at some subsequent session. And then if this committee has established that as a practice, I would suggest that there might be some regrets. I know that with the next bill we have coming up that there actually, I think there are a couple of policy pieces where some of us might have some substantive difference. Understand your explanation. Understand the combination of committees. Make it again clear that Senator Michelle has done that to a much lesser extent, but wanted to raise that and get the explanation from yourself, which I appreciate.
I appreciate you expressing yourself on it. I know that you know about all those little tricks that used to be used and have, sometimes proven effective and sometimes not. And we probably will have policy included in a number of these omnibus bills, like it has been in the past. Certainly, we will try to have most of those heard in the Committee of Jurisdiction and not in the Finance Committee. I would not really appreciate new policy coming in finance.
And Madam Chair, let me just indicate that as best I can recall, I never, ever, ever did this ever, as best I know. as best I can recollect.
What a joker.
Senator Shaw.
Madam Chair, I was just going to say, Senator, I found it helpful at times that Senator Cohen is on the Jobs Committee as well.
At times.
He said at times.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, back to the competitive grants piece. Senator Michelle, I'm kind of worried about putting this all together so quickly. Somebody is going to have to make sure that there are standards, that there's an RFP process that's long enough that people know that it's there and have a chance to put their proposals in to compete. Just such a different way of doing things. And I'm wondering whether it wouldn't be appropriate to move an effective date back a year or something along those lines, so that people have time to prepare rather than just saying, it's now March and in July or August, it's all going to be way different. That's an awfully short timeline.
And
Senator Michelle.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, we had we have wrestled, and I would say we're still wrestling with the timing and the transition. And so I would argue there's still work for the Jobs Committee to do. And I was going to mention specifically, so we had Senators Metzen and Senator Miller kind of wrestling with
it's a mental picture. I don't
Oh, sorry. So, thinking hard and working with Senate counsel. And so I am committed to still look into that transition and timing issue. We even set up the hypothetical, okay, what if you did it a year later? And we actually, I would summarize that we encountered more issues than we anticipated. It wasn't quite as easy as just turning it on and off. So I don't know if I'm not sure that'll give you comfort, as much comfort as you'd like, Senator Higgins, but I am open to, and I have talked with many of the parties involved to still working on how we turn this on.
And Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, I'd like to help work on that piece with you, if you wouldn't mind.
Thank you.
And then may I ask another question on a different subject, Senator?
Yes, Senator Higgins.
Okay. On the Housing Trust Fund, funds that I think the governor recommended a $2 million increase, and this bill does not do that. And I understand that there would be a pretty severe loss of federal funding by us not putting this $2 million in. And can you tell us about that? And if there are any other places in your bill where we lose federal funds because of something that's in here.
Senator Michelle.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I'll ask Mr. Jensen to highlight any of the specific spreadsheet items there, but I would say I know there's maybe half a dozen instances where the governor used an increased from the base, and we did not do that as a committee in any of those instances, but particularly with the Housing Trust Fund, we did want to prioritize it, and so we have not made any cut from the base with the Housing Trust Fund, and we took and we heard a lot of testimony on the benefits of that program. So we wanted to recognize and prioritize it and not make real cuts as we have in other areas of the bill. But we were not able to find new monies for it given our target and our circumstances.
And
Senator Higgins?
So, Mr. Chair, if I understood correctly, the deputy commissioner told your committee that we would lose $18 million that would have to be sent back to the federal government. We would lose about 100 FTEs, and 1,200 people would be put on housing waiting lists.
Okay.
That's pretty severe for
Chairman. Senator Michelle.
If you, Mr. Jensen, I think is he will respond, and I don't recall those numbers, Senator Higgins.
That's Mr. Jensen.
Mr. Chairman, members. Yes, the amount of money that would have gone into the Volk Rehab Fund and the Blind Services Fund, that would have earned about 3.7 federal dollars for each $1 of state dollars. And that's how the deputy commissioner multiplied that out and got something like $16 to $18 million.
Senator Higgins, you have a follow-up?
My thinking just slowed way down, Mr. Chair. So maybe somebody else who was on the committee who remembers the conversation.
Senator Cohen?
Well, Mr. Chairman, on a couple of different things. Although I will say, Mr. Chairman, Senator Michelle, I agree with Senator Higgins' concern, but I'll tell you, Senator Higgins, I was expecting the housing programs generally to take such a huge hit in the Senate that I almost viewed that as not a victory, but I thought the housing monies, and you and I have talked about that, have been concerned about the housing monies were much better treated than a lot of other things in this process. But let me just address, Mr. Chairman, if I might, a couple of concerns I do have. And Senator Michelle has heard this, obviously, in his committee. The first members is the abolition of the trade office. One of the mantra this year has been from everybody, we're going to create jobs, or whatever. And a place where that has been effectively done directly is the trade office. I mean, you create jobs a couple of different ways. I mean, you do some long-term stuff. If we want to talk about reducing the corporate tax rate, you can make that. Some folks can make that argument. Some folks will suggest there's nothing government can really do to create a jobs environment. But the trade office is a place that has been able to, with a fairly limited turnaround, work with particularly small and mid-sized businesses to create foreign markets. The comment I made in Sarah Michelle's committee was that certainly if you have a place like Cargill or the large Fortune 500 multinational companies, they have the ability to have a trade office directly within their business. That's arguably not difficult for them. But certainly for the smaller Minnesota concerns that manufacturing concern that has everything it can do to keep folks employed, keep a business operating, to be able to explore foreign markets is something that's difficult to do without some kind of outside source of support. And a trade office has been the mechanism to do that, has worked successfully in many states in the country. And I think the abolition of the trade office is a mistake, particularly in the absence of any replacement. I know, Sir Michelle, you talked in the committee about whether or not this is something that could be absorbed within the governor's office. But as I indicated in Sir Perry's there, in State Departments, as best I know, that's not being done. So we kind of leave that out hanging. And I hope it's something that can be resolved as the process goes on. So I do want to mention that to the full committee. And, Madam Chair, if you have the gavel back, the other issue I want to raise, if I might, is one, to be blunt, that's a geographic issue, one that doesn't affect me or affect my district. But there is $45 million being taken from the Doug Johnson Fund. And I know that there's a lot of discussion around this place about northeastern Minnesota and what they've done, what they've not done. Senator Thomasoni and Senator Michelle's committee gave a good history of the fund, gave a good history, and Commissioner Sertich did as well in his testimony, of what that's all about. And the essence of what they were saying is, look, this was set up statutorily as our economic development money. In effect, it's money in lieu of property taxes. That's how historically it was set up with the mining companies. And so now, unilaterally, you're taking it. The other thing that is of concern with the provision is that it's one-time money. Now, have we used one-time money in the past to make up these budget deficits? Sure we have. Is it a good practice? No, it's not. That's what's led to a structurally unbalanced budget in this state that keeps on, that has us keep on coming back in the hole over and over again. Now, this amount's a smaller amount. It's not like, say, the K-12 shift. But there's another twist to it, and that is that we have to pay it back. So not only do we have one-time money we're using, but then we pay it back. So in that respect, I guess, Senator Langs, you were mentioning to me, as I think about it, it really is like a shift in that respect. So I think as a matter of budgeting, it's not a good idea. But I think more than that, there's also the question of equity. And it's of concern. I hesitate to speak because I don't serve on Senator Olson's committee, but we know that there is concern on the part of the majority with, say, St. Paul, Minneapolis, compensatory ed, and integration aid. Okay, we understand that. But where there's an attempt to take significant dollars from geographic parts of the state because there's, to be blunt, we don't have members who are members of the majority, that's something I don't think the previous majority ever did. We could get into debates about, say, exurban areas versus urban centers, rural Minnesota versus metropolitan Minnesota. But I think taking the Doug Johnson money, as has been the case in this bill, goes beyond that. And I hope it's not symptomatic of other bills we're going to see during the course of the finance bills in this committee. Because once a legislature clearly goes down that road, this isn't meant as a threat, but listen, we were in the majority for however many years, Sir Langseth, you were?
38.
Okay, all right. Okay, 38. So maybe it'll be another 38 years before the majority changes again. And then Senator Langseth claims he won't be here. I'll believe that when I see it. But, you know, maybe that legislature in 38 years is going to say, okay, we're tired of it. And now we're going to do the same thing. And I just don't think that's a very good idea in terms of how we run the state of Minnesota. There's always going to be the geographic tension. That's inevitable. But to then make it part of public policy in such a fashion, I think, is a serious mistake. And so that's why if there's a part of the bill, Sarah Michelle, that I would object to, I've raised concerns about, you know, a couple pieces of the bill, you know, the trade office. But, you know, that's a statewide issue. But I think to go after geographies is a significant mistake. Recognize we've got a tough budget. I'm, to say the least, sympathetic and not in any way envious of the problems you have in that respect. Just think it's a mistake.
Madam Chair.
Senator Langseth.
Senator Cohen, wait till the tax bill. You'll see what they do to northwestern Minnesota. Balances off. Both northeastern and northwestern will be hitting the ice.
Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I hate to see this degenerate into this kind of argument because I don't want to have to get in and enter it, having been around here for quite a few years, too. That path goes more than one way. And it's, you know, it's yes, we're in a time of constraint, but there have been some inequities created when times are flush. And that also, there are efforts, maybe some are looked as being punitive. Not necessarily so. I think there's some efforts on the part of Senator Michelle in this area to bring some accountability and some oversight and through some of the competitive grants. We're trying to find in education ways, are we getting the return for the kind of investment that we're making for certain purposes and for certain situations, and what has it done in terms of changing the results in education? And if it's not, then we need to be seeing. And I'm not trying to punish anybody. I will tell you that. But it's obviously easier to make some of those changes if you've got money that you can throw at it. We're not in that kind of situation, and I don't know when we ever will be again. And so we do really need to see what is it that we are trying to accomplish and how do we get there using the resources we have and try to do it, inflict as little pain as we can. So I hope we don't continue along this debate before you, because I want to remain calm and gracious and respectful.
Briefly, please.
And I would be the last person who would want to force Senator Olson out of her normal demeanor. So let me make it clear. I was not trying to put anybody on the defensive, and not to suggest that some of these inequities had not taken place in the past. That's number one. Number two, I wasn't making a reference to the competitive grant program. No. Three, I was making a particular reference to the use of the Doug Johnson Fund. And serving on Sarah Michelle's committee, I did not hear a discussion about policy or the need to take a look at the program, whatever. What I heard was, we need the money, is a paraphrase of what I heard in Sarah Michelle's committee as to why that particular provision is there. That's a little bit different from Senator Olson, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, when we see your bill, where I will listen as you make the arguments in terms of equity, policy, and so on. I was just addressing that particular provision in Sarah Michelle's bill.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been around here enough, but I've never been a member in the majorities. But I'm just going to have to say that, you know, the one thing I've watched over the years is the structural imbalance that we have, and been very disturbed about it, because finance has been an important issue, state finance, to me over the years. And what I told people when I ran for office is that I wasn't going to support shifts. And I wasn't going to support moving the problem on to the next year. I'm concerned that this one-time money from the Doug Johnson Fund does that, as well as some of the other stuff that's happened in some of the other committees. And I really think we need to make our absolute best effort together to make sure that this budget is balanced and we don't come back in 2 years and have the same kind of problem, because I don't think any of us want that. This has been going on for 9 years, and we've had 8 of the last 9 years of a shortfall, and a lot of that was because of just moving money around. So this is a new day. We're lots of different members here, but I think we really have to make an extra hard effort to make sure that this budget is truly balanced when we leave here. And then for Senator Michelle, Madam Chair, I've got a couple of questions, if it's okay if I go
Please
on.
Go ahead.
Senator Michelle, overall in your bill, can you tell me how many jobs are created or how many jobs are lost by the proposals you have in your bill?
Madam Chair, I will take Senator Goodwin's question as I'll take it on faith that that's a serious question, but
yes.
and I'm going to answer it seriously. I think the state legislature needs to get out of that business, the business of declaring that this bill just created X number of jobs and this bonding bill just created X number of jobs. I think we need to approach this with a little more humility than that. We don't have magic buttons here in St. Paul. We have a few levers that we can work to help the economy, and I think we've identified those and we're working on them. But this is a bill that funds several state agencies, boards, and commissions, and it funds it in a way that meets our budget target. Yes, it's called the Senate Jobs Committee. But I'm not going to attach a number to that, and I think it's a mistake when members attach specific job numbers and raise expectations like that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you. And Senator Michelle, you know, we may have a difference of opinion on whether or not government can create jobs, but we certainly have to agree that government can certainly end jobs. And I don't care if they're public sector jobs, nonprofit jobs, or private jobs, because what we do here affects jobs as far as not having them at the very least. So I know we can't come out of this session without any job loss. We've got too big of a budget shortfall. But I would hope that at least in some of these bills, but that we're going to be very careful about the number of jobs that are going to be lost and how we decide how to cut this budget to make the least damage, because there's sure a lot of people out there that are still looking for jobs, and there'll be a lot more when we're all done here. And I guess the other question I have for you is, what is the total amount of fees in this bill? What are we raising in fees?
Senator.
Madam Chair, I'll ask Mr. Jensen to highlight. We really made an effort to scrub this bill of fees. I think there are. I know there's some. We're taking this group, which used to be called the Boxing Commission, and it's now the Combative Sports Commission. And so we're taking them off. That's an interesting discussion right there. We're taking them off the general fund, and they will now be self-sustaining. So we do have a page of fees that they will be charging. I'm sure there's a couple other instances as well.
Mr. Jensen?
Madam Chair, for the Combative Sports Commission, the fee increase is about $33,000 a year, and that will stay with the commission. That's fees for judges, referees, et cetera, and all that money stays with the commission. The other fee is in labor and industry, where we're extending the surcharge on billing permits, and that's a $5 fee. And that's extended for only 2 years, and that raises that about $1.2 million each year. Those are the only fees in the bill.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
This is one thing, Senator Mitchell, we agree on, is the Boxing Commission, and that they should be self-supporting. The issue with the my brain is gone, too. The fees. Oh, I know. Never mind. I got it. The building permit issue. That I assume is money that's going into the general fund. No?
Madam Chair, no. That money stays in the Labor and Industry Department in the Code Consolidation Fund.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Senator. Chair, could I also add that there was a fee extension in the bill, which the committee did not do, which was the petroleum tax increase. And that would have raised $6.2 million in fiscal year 2013. The committee did not do that.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen.
Senator Olson?
Thank you. I was just going to ask, I didn't note what the new combative sports commission's responsibilities were, but I just wondered if you included any oversight of the legislature in that responsibility.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, there's actually language, legislative language, that refers to a knockdown judge. that's a term I hadn't heard before. And there may be some application to the next 60 days here.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Michelle, I wanted to just understand a little more about your thinking on the getting rid of the Trade Commission. I understand that you're thinking perhaps that could be in the governor's office. Have you spoken to the governor? Have you had any relationship or conversations with the new regional authority? I'm pretty excited. You know, the Itasca group created this new regional effort and have now hired a top-notch executive to come in and take the leadership. And I think that wherever this is housed, and I don't have any view that it should be here or the governor's office, but I do think that we ought to leverage this new funded authority with our interest in getting and businesses from overseas to choose Minnesota. I think that, you know, no, we can't create jobs, but we can be part of an effort to creating an environment where they pick Minnesota.
Senator Michelle.
Madam Chair, I agree, Senator Bonhoff, and the Itasca group is one example of a new private group that would have a pretty strong interest in trade and in growing trade and in growing exports, and that absolutely has to be a part of the future for our economy. And my point, I do not want anyone to walk away thinking this proposal has been agreed to on the trade office by the governor. He has not agreed to that in any way, and there haven't been any formal conversations. What I would say, and I think we had some good discussion in our committee about this, you know, we need a governor to lead on trade, and I think we have a governor who wants to lead on trade. I know there's some plans for a trip to China yet this calendar year, and so that may have been some of the governor's motivation when he earlier talked about in the campaign about eliminating the office. I think he felt it was misused by previous governors, and he used the phrases like junkets. And but, you know, more to the point, there's a public-private partnership possibility here. There is coordination with or even an actual housing of this function within the governor's office that is done in some other states. So I think there's a number of options, and the Itasca group is another one to pursue.
Madam Chair. So, Senator Michelle, I would just encourage you personally to follow up with the governor on this issue, because I think that we want to keep it at the top of the list in terms of the legislature's communication that this is important.
Maybe time to see if there's anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against the proposal. We did have Jean Lee on our testifying list.
Members of the committee.
Ms. Lee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers, and I head APAC, the Asia Pacific American Housing Consortium. I didn't get a chance to testify in the Jobs Committee. I was put on the list, but I was in another committee testifying when the things went through. So, but I wanted to raise a couple few issues here. First of all, a brief background, Children's Hope International R&R Family Centers is a private nonprofit. It's been in business since 1974, and we've never received any government funds. Our core areas have been economic development, education, healthcare, housing, justice, public policy, technology, and victim services. And we have done more as far as some of the same things that other organizations who have been before the different committees have testified that they receive government aid to do. APAC is a group of 15 unfunded service providers in the area of housing. And these, the APAC organization also includes realtors, lenders, developers, and others in the housing industry, and we're growing. We service over 200,000 in the API community, and our services also extend to all other Minnesotans. We have partnerships and collaboratives. We have targets now to serve over 400,000 in the veterans area as far as an initiative. And last year, we started drafting a policy to house all the homeless by doing things differently. Now, I'm a former corporate auditor for companies, which includes Fortune 500 companies, a former financial executive, realtor, and lender. I'm a small business owner, general contractor, developer, and I've done grant reviews and audits of programs. I have an MBA, was a CPA, and I currently have certifications in housing counseling. And the reason why I raise these issues is because we have pioneered in a number of areas, and we had some things to address related to the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency section. As I mentioned, there are a couple areas in this Section 5 that relate to, one relates to the homeless prevention, in which we found that in prior years, the money was already awarded out before the funds were even determined by the legislature. So there was no opportunity for competitive, when you talk about competitive grant and bid process. And so we're concerned. We haven't looked at all the others and see if the different funds that are awarded are also handled this way. But as you talk about being open to competitive bid process or competitive grant process, that opportunity be available for those who have not yet been at the table. In the section, subdivision 9 and also 10, there are capacity building grants, and there's also what we call the home ownership education counseling training. Now, for about 4 years, our organization has tried to get funding for these service providers since part of their counseling also involves home ownership issues and other issues related to housing as they're providing social services. However, according to law, it says in order to be a counseling agency, you have to either be funded by Minnesota Housing Finance Agency or approved by HUD. And the problem there is HUD does not approve agencies unless they've been at least a year as a counseling agency. So the only way you could become a counseling agency is if you got funded by MFHA. So the groups that aren't technically in this pool. By eliminating them from the HUD funds, they also get eliminated out of the training, out of money for program staff, out of any funds for, like some of them are in development, funds that come through the HUD program for development of that some of these others need matching federal grants for, and they can't even compete because of, you know, these technical barriers. So we were asking for an amendment to kind of remove some of the barriers and make it more accessible. We also had issues where we found that there was discrimination. So on the reverse side, as far as you were talking about earmarks, not allowing earmarks, there was also issues as far as groups that were being discriminated against. So we were looking for the truly balanced playing field. And then the third area is that this is also an area under the home ownership education and training, that it's an area where you can potentially generate revenue because counselors are able to charge fees to the clients. And they have a program now set up so that through the lending system, everyone has to take these courses, and therefore it's a guaranteed generation. And so we see this as a potential area for reduction, but first you got to get in the game first. And so this is an area you might think as far as how to make it work. And the reason I also raise these issues is because we had a project where we tried to help these agencies go through, which would have resulted in 30 jobs. But because there were these barriers, these groups could not get the leverage, the money that they might have gotten from these a little bit of funding to leverage them to get 30 jobs. And then that also created the situation where one of the housing projects, which they also couldn't get federal funds for, was a $100 million project. It created 1,500 jobs, and that created also rental units of 700. And these were also for entrepreneurs, so that it in itself generated more jobs and potential sales and so forth. So we're talking kind of a chain reaction of things happening here. So we were looking for language that would kind of open the field up and make things possible. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ms. Lee. It sounds like you're looking for a competitive grant for the housing, the affordable housing, just like we have for the workforce development grants in the bill. Is that sort of what you're thinking?
A true competitive as far as the grants in the areas where it's all open, it's not already they've decided who gets it, because even under the home ownership counseling, there were arbitrary decisions made by some people. They'd sit across from you and say, I'm going to make sure you get a grant, and that was not a competitive process. And so on the other side, when they're discriminating against the groups, you know they weren't going to get the funds. And so a true competitive process where it was a level playing field is one. And the other issue was that if some of these groups already had a bite of the apple and were taking other bites and so forth, we think that as tight as the situation is, or the money situation, especially when we found out some of these groups not only were going into the competitive round, they were asking for earmarks in prior years, so they were like double dipping, triple dipping, and so forth to do the same thing, that not be allowed. And so technically there's a fair competition and fairness behind the issues.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. And Senator Michelle will probably like to, I mean, at some point he'd probably like to extend the competitiveness of other program funding. He'll have to see if this one works well. We may be expanding that further in the future. So thank you for your comments. We do have Katie Clark from the director of the trade office is here and would like to address us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, Mr. Chairman Michelle. Good to see you. I'm Katie Clark, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Trade Office, and given today's discussion and the proposal to completely eliminate the Trade Office's general fund, wanted to share some information with you today. 95% of the world's population and 75% of consumers live outside of the United States. Companies that export are 20% more productive and 9% less likely to go bankrupt due to being able to better mitigate market fluctuations and extend their product life cycle. Companies that export pay employees 18% higher wages and 37% higher benefits, and experience greater job growth than non-exporters. The Trade Office has a biennial general fund of $3,142,000 and does not receive any federal grant dollars. Our general fund is 77% payroll, and 23% is spent on space rental, utilities, computers, HR, IT marketing, and travel, which is just over 1% of our total budget. All the other expenses for the services that we provide, our export consulting, training, trade missions, are all paid for by private dollars by the companies that participate in those trainings and in the trade missions. 9 of the 14 employees in the trade office are international trade representatives with specific international expertise, bilingual skills, and business relationships overseas. They are each responsible for a different international market, Canada and Mexico, Europe and Russia, Greater China, and provide training and export consulting to Minnesota companies on how to export their products to those specific markets that each have different regulatory and cultural barriers to export success. The majority of these employees have worked for the trade office for more than 15 years and have long-standing partnerships with Minnesota companies as well as companies overseas. They have also lived and worked overseas and have the skills needed to guide Minnesota companies to navigate overseas to increase exports, increase sales, and increase jobs here in Minnesota. Since 2000, Minnesota's manufactured good exports have grown from $10.3 billion to $19 billion in 2010. If you take the average of the past 5 years and apply that going forward, we have the potential to almost double that $19 billion worth of exports. A few companies that I can use as an examples. One is Ideal Aerosmith from East Grand Forks, Minnesota, that makes precision guidance test systems. Their international sales volumes have increased by 83% since 2007, and they've experienced more than 16% growth in employment since 2007 and are currently selling to 17 countries worldwide. And they are a partner of the trade office and have utilized our services. MOCON out of Brooklyn Park, Minnesota, solutions for measuring the permeation of gases and water vapor through barriers and films. 56% of total revenue is from international sales, installations in 79 countries on 6 continents, and they've experienced 11% growth in employment and have and are supported by a supplier network of 524 Minnesota companies. And last, the trade office is focused primarily on small to mid-sized companies across the state, as those are the companies that truly have a need for our services. But we also help the Fortune 500 companies across the state. 3M, based out of St. Paul, more than 63% of total revenues from international sales, the 40th largest exporter by volume. In one instance of when we assisted 3M, they were trying to market a product in India that was delayed by tariff misclassification. The trade office petitioned the government of India and was able to reclassify the product, which allowed them to export that product overseas. In addition, as a part of a Minnesota trade office-led trip to Vietnam, Minnesota-based Harmony Enterprises sold recycling equipment to a Vietnamese bottling company, which led to additional sales to customers in Vietnam. And after making contacts to a trip to Thailand, Duluth Flatwater Fleet sold well rehabilitation equipment valued at nearly $4 million, a significant sale for such a small firm. The trade office organized the trip, facilitated all the business contacts overseas, and provided sustained follow-up assistance leading up to the sale. I thank you for your time today. Just wanted to bring this to your attention. I understand there are comments by Governor Dayton on the campaign trail, but I urge you to look at his budget proposal and to also consider the great value that the Minnesota Trade Office is bringing to small and mid-sized companies across the state and the important resource that we're providing.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Clark. I missed one figure that when you first started. I don't know if I've what happened, but in terms of your balance of funding, I think you mentioned something about having some federal funds. Could you lay out the proportion of funds from varying sources for me again?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Higgins, Senator Olson. I apologize. Our general fund budget is $3,142,000. We do not receive any federal funds.
Okay.
And that general fund is 77% payroll.
Okay.
Are there any other questions for Ms. Clark? Thank you for your testimony, Ms.
Thank
Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify? If not, are there any other questions about the bill from the committee members? Senator Michelle, we have several members in the Judiciary Committee taking a vote right now, and as a courtesy to them, we're going to give them time to get here. So I don't know if you have any final words to say about your proposal.
Madam Chair, final words, you make that sound like the condemned.
There's a moment of silence.
Madam Chair, I actually, at the risk of bringing up a sensitive topic, but I do this because I really believe it was funny. It's a serious topic, but it was funny. So Senator Tomasoni, in a very passionate debate on the IRRB transfer, the loan within this package, he, to his credit, brought to the committee an amendment that would balance. That would balance. And I'm going to hold on to this amendment. I'll share it with you, but I'm going to hold on to it because I think it might be one of the better amendments of the entire legislative session. So what Senator Tomasoni what Senator Tomasoni's amendment did was he made a partial transfer out of that IRRB Doug Johnson fund, but then he named, in the language of the amendment, he named four specific Senate districts. And they might have been majority party districts, and said the rest of the money to equal the transfer that's in the bill would come from those specific districts. So it was Senator Nelson, Senator DeKreif, Senator Lilly, and my Senate district. So I'm holding on to this because I think it is one of the more imaginatively drafted, and it was certainly budgetarily honest. And again, I know it's a sensitive topic, members, but Senator Tomasoni was trying to prove a point.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Michelle, what we didn't talk about was I had to talk Senator Tomasoni off the ledge because he views your district as such a successful district. He wanted to simply take it from your district.
Yeah.
I said that's not fair.
So I should be thanking Senator Cohen, Madam Chair.
Why, I wasn't included.
Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, does he have the method
district
of extraction from those districts identified?
I wondered that, too.
No. But I have the language, Senator Olson, if that should ever be useful to you and your committee deliberations.
And it looks like some of the members from the Judiciary Committee have returned. I don't know where other members have gone to. But I think we're probably ready to entertain a motion. I think Senator Newman is actually chairing the Judiciary Committee right now, so I don't know if we can expect him back or not. I'm not sure. Senator Langseth was here. I don't know where he's gone to. Does anyone know?
Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, I just came from that meeting, and we have been good enough to go back and forth with the votes here with Senator Goodwin, myself, and Senator Newman. So I'm sure if somebody would go down and get those bodies, we'd be, if you're ready to move, or
here comes Senator Goodwin.
Sorry, No.
Two more coming, Madam Chair.
Oh, and here comes Senator Newman.
Oh,
okay.
Do you have the gavel?
And does anyone know where Senator Langseth went?
Finally, get a gavel.
He's going to tell us where he was leaving. So, otherwise, let's see who has a motion on Senator Michelle's bill. Senate File 887. Senator Hand.
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 887 be passed and referred to the floor.
Okay. Senator Hand moves that Senate File 887, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the floor. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay.
No.
No.
The motion does prevail. The bill is approved and will be sent to the floor. Thank you, Senator Michelle.
Thank you, members.
What calls did we have yesterday?
What?
Members, I think we're going to I hate to have a recess because I know we lose too many people, but I know some people have other committees to get to, but we do want to start with the higher ed bill right away.
That's good. thought this one.
Our next bill on the agenda is the Senate Payer Ed Bill from the committee. It is Senate File 924, and Senator Fischbach will be presenting.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Weidman is here with me today, and she can go through the spreadsheet. Maybe that's the best way to start, is going through that and hitting the high points of the spreadsheet, since this is the Finance Committee. If that's an acceptable way to proceed with you, Madam Chair, we will start with looking over that spreadsheet.
That would be appropriate. We always look at everything financial, as I said before.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Weidman.
Madam Chair, members, we had to reduce our spending from a biennial total of about $2.9 billion to $2.5 billion. Most of that was accomplished by making cuts in funding to the University of Minnesota and MinSCU. We did make some changes to funding for various programs that are offered by administered by the Office of Higher Education, about $684,000 in changes there. And I'll go through those as we go through the spreadsheet. We can start on page one, and I'll pretty much be talking off the numbers that are in the column headed Senate Rec for 12 and 13. Lines 3 through 11A are various agency administration functions within the Office of Higher Education. The committee's decision there was to just have a 10% reduction in their administrative costs and allow them to allocate those reductions to the various line items specified there. Lines 15 through 18 deal with the state grant program, which is a need-based financial aid program. The biennial funding level for that is about $288 million. We're going to be seeing a need to ration that program because of increased demand for it. We cut funding in several other programs and are adding about $7.4 million to that program to try to reduce the rationing that will have to occur. Lines 23 through 28 are various other financial aid programs. We took the money, the $4.7 million that had been appropriated for the Achieve Scholarship Program, and moved that money into the state grant program. There was like a 10% cut to funding for Indian scholarships. Child care grants, tuition reciprocity, and work study were funded at their base level amounts. Continuing on page 2, lines 36 through 44 are various academic support programs for students. Those various line items, we did base level funding for Get Ready program, Midwest Compact, the Minnesota Minority Partnership, Student Parent Information, and United Family Practice, which provides funding for family practice residents. And then we did do a 10% reduction to the ICAP program and to MinLink and Minitex. There's base level funding for mail. There are two appropriations there. One provides a capitation amount for medical students who are Minnesota residents, and then there is also a capitation for family medicine residents. Continuing on lines 57 through 59, the line 57 is the operations and maintenance funding for SKU. Eight is the funding for the central office and shared services, and line 59 is the funding for the learning network, which we cut the funding for that by 10%. You'll see the Senate rec number, the $66 million on the central office. If you look over under the February forecast, what we did there, it's about $92 million. And the reason for that dramatic reduction is that we moved $16 million per year, which is used for president's salaries and benefits, up into the operations and maintenance line, so that central office line dollars reflect purely salaries and benefits for individuals that work in that office and are not necessarily tied to the campuses. And then continuing on page 3, line 65 through 70 is funding for the University of Minnesota. Line 66 through 70 are the various state specials. Those were each reduced by about 6%, except for Mayo, which is funded at the fiscal 11 funding level. You go down to line 77, you'll see that our total reduction of the $411,062,000 in 12 and 13, and just slightly more in 14 and 15, which is due to the fact that there's some matching grants for a college savings program, and that will be eliminated.
Thank you, Ms. Weidman. You know, just as a point of historical reference here, last year we took $130 million out of this budget, and it was backfilled generally by federal stimulus dollars that went to the campuses. And that, of course, is no longer available. So this would continue part of that state cut and then add some more for a total amount of $411 million. And so just to remember that last year we had reduced the base, but it was scheduled to be only a one-time cut, and that it came back again this year. So it's not all new cuts, but a continuation of some cuts and then some additional cuts as well. Are there other questions, Senator Berglund?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Fischbach, do you know under the bill what the cuts will mean in terms of residency programs or how it will affect our ability to meet our health care workforce needs?
Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I guess if you're asking about specific programs, if you on the residency issues, I think that some of those are addressed. Is that what you're asking?
I'm asking if we're going to have any reduction in those programs.
And Madam Chair, to the best of my knowledge, no, in those residency programs.
Senator Berglund, there was a proposal in the governor's budget to take out the United Family Practice residency funding, but that money is in this bill at base level, as are the rest of the funds for the residency programs are at base level.
And Madam Chair, I just wanted to really briefly just about pages 1 through 11 of the first engrossment kind of tie into, and if this is acceptable, Madam Chair, tie into the spreadsheet, and if you wanted me to go through those other pages and just very briefly explain what's in the rest of it, if that's acceptable or...
Yes, Senator Fischbach, why don't you go through?
We'll just start on page 11, given, like I said, that pages 1 through 11 are the language and the numbers tied to the spreadsheet that Ms. Weidman explained. On page 11, starting on section 7 there on line 1126, this is the tuition cap at MinSKU that would cap tuition increases at 3% for the state colleges and 4% for the university. Then the language at the bottom of the page that goes over to the next page 12 is the expectation that the U of M would follow those kinds of 4% tuition increase. On lines 12.5 through 12.10, that language is basically providing direction if another bill that is potentially, if another bill, there are several bills making their way through now that would either freeze or cut salary, and that language provides direction to Minsky what to do in that case. It's a little bit of a placeholder, but also if for some reason this happened before that bill was finished, we'd have some direction for them. Under Section 10, this language currently, if there are insufficient funds in the state grant program, the family and student share are reduced equally. This language that's provided here would push the family share up, and as a result, the state grants would be pushed to lower income families. Just to deal with that, then the second portion is it? That's correct.
Right? Mm-hmm.
Oh, and then the second portion on Section 11 is a Benson bill on a study for-profit graduate education. Then on page 13 at the beginning, that's a small bill that I had that changes the age for being considered a senior citizen if you're taking a class. And it was changed last year to 66, and we're just changing it back to 62. Under the self-loan revenue bonds and the annual certificate of need, this is some language from the Office of Higher Education that they had recommended. It's comfort language for the underwriters, and there's no obligation that the state expend any dollars there, just some comfort language. Next page is technical language regarding the changes and the elimination of the savings plan match so that because we did eliminate that match, as did the governor's recommendations. That's just technical language we need. And then on page 15, it's the prohibition of the use of state funds for human cloning. And finally, on page 16, there's some repealer language, and that is also included in the matching grant language repeal. We need to be consistent, so some of that language had to be repealed. And that's pretty much it.
Thank you. Are there questions from members? Senator Bana.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a small question and then one that will probably take some more time. So I'll start with the small question first. The small question had to do with the cut in the Central Office and Shared Services Unit. When I worked on exploring the use of shared services in the K-12 arena, the folks from Minsky and higher ed came to see me to share with me the successes they've had in their model and the cost savings they've had with their model. So I wonder if there's going to be actually a decrease in productivity and a related increase in cost if we in fact cut this area. Do you know whether or not there's going to be what the fallout of that cut will be?
Senator Fischbach?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoff, not as specifically as that. It may be if someone would like to come up from Minsky, they might be able to be more specific on that if someone is here to answer that.
Is there someone from Minsky who would like to address that question?
Good afternoon. Judy Borgen, Associate Vice Chancellor in Budget. Basically, what the office reduction is as Ms. Weidman said, that is just a shifting of the presidential salaries. So that's what the big number is there. The balance of it is a reduction in our office. I don't believe that it would significantly change what we're trying to do in the shared service arena.
Good. Thank you. Now, Madam Chair, if I might, the rather larger philosophical discussion. I understand why it's in the finance bill because it seems to be finance-related, but I am very concerned about the provision with regard to cloning. Direct me what, Madam Chair, which page, Senator Fischbach, 15, are we
page
on?
Page 15, lines 15, 16.
16. Okay. So, Senator Fischbach, I understand that when we hear the word cloning, we all think of it as creating you know, another person from a manufactured type thing, and that is a distasteful thing for at least me, I'm sure most people, when you think about it, and we've all seen that in the movies. But I don't think that's what this is just covering. I think what we're talking about here is using this bill to curtail the University of Minnesota and Mayo Clinic's ability to do significant amount of stem cell research. And that is, I think it's a major concern, philosophically putting that aside, because we're the finance committee, and I don't think this is the appropriate place to have that philosophical discussion. But even from a financial perspective, if we want to be a leader, research and development university leader in the country, to have this provision in there, I think will curtail our ability to create the kind of research that will, in fact, change lives, be on the medical forefront. Those of you who have family members with health problems, I mean, there's just all sorts of implications that it's just a couple lines in this bill, and you might just read it and think, oh, but when you peel the onion back a little bit, this is of great concern, and I don't know. As I understand it, it didn't go through the Health and Human Services. It went through higher ed, and I'm concerned about that, and I'm concerned that we've actually limited not just state dollars, but these institutions' ability to access federal dollars. So it's a pretty sweeping thing that's been put in this bill.
Senator Fischbach.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoff, there was a bill regarding cloning, not the exact language that appears here, that went through the Health Committee, the Judiciary Committee, and the Higher Ed Committee. This is a little bit, this language is a little bit different. But basically what it does is it says no state funds or federal funds the state receives for state programs. This is not the exact language, but there's very similar language that appeared 2 years ago in 2009 in the higher education bill. And that's where that is where it appeared 2 years ago. And so it seems fitting that it would be in the higher education bill. I think the only difference, I won't even talk about the only difference at this point because I'm not 100% sure. But, you know, I think this is a legitimate place for the language. And I think it's very specific on the state funds and that they can't be used for human cloning.
Senator Berglund.
Chair, maybe there's someone here that could explain to me what the difference would be between genetically cloning something and doing stem cell research, which could produce medical cures. I do believe that there is a difference.
Senator Berglund. We have Dr. Aaron Friedman, who has signed up to testify from the University of Minnesota Medical School. If he's here, might be a good time for him to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senators. There are some significant differences between...
Just for the tape, would you identify yourself?
I'm sorry. Thank you. I'm Aaron Friedman. I'm the Vice President for the Health Sciences and the Dean of the Medical School. And I do welcome the opportunity to address that question and others. There is a significant difference between banning human cloning and preventing stem cell research. At the present time, there is no human cloning going on at the University of Minnesota. There is stem cell research going on. And this bill, this provision, has sent a chilling effect to our researchers, including sending the message that it would be better to be elsewhere, where having to dodge the questions of whether we will be able to continue to do our research won't occur. We have about $30 million of investment in stem cell research at the university right now. That's in facilities, it's in people, it's in equipment. That is for that specific research alone. Many of our researchers have other activities that are going on in those laboratories that may, in fact, not be stem cell research. But should they go, they take all of it. That's one issue. The second, and the reason I feel very strongly about this, is my own background. I'm a pediatrician. I started in 1974 as an intern in pediatrics. I've had the opportunity, the privilege, of taking care of children and babies for that is 37 years. Probably hundreds of babies, if not thousands of children. And I've had the dismaying opportunity to stand or sit in front of families and say, we can't do any more for your child. We can't do that because your child has something that we cannot correct. Stem cells have made a difference for some of those conditions and offer the opportunity of making substantial difference for other children. That's why we feel so strongly about this provision and the chilling effect it will have, not only at the university, but for the patients we take care of.
Dr. Friedman, under current law, you are under a similar provision, though, are you not? I believe it was passed in 2009, and it said that state funds could not be used for I don't know if it was cloning or embryonic stem cell research.
It's cloning.
It was for cloning. And in many regards, this would be a continuation of that ban. Doesn't necessarily prohibit the research, but it does prohibit it with state dollars.
And federal.
Madam Chair and Senators, it actually extends it because it specifies certain forms of stem cells. And today, even though there are a variety of different ways to create stem cells, this particular way of creating them is important because it is the most what's called pluripotent. In other words, it is the most dedifferentiated. It offers the most opportunity to be able to move from a cell that has no specific direction to one that can be directed to be a nerve cell, a heart cell, a liver cell, a bone marrow cell. So it actually goes beyond where we are today.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. Sir, could you explain or indicate what the balance of research at the university is going on between the type of stem cell research referenced here versus the adult stem cell research or stem cells taken from a person's own body? It seems to me every time I read about some breakthrough, it's from the latter, not the former. And I've often wondered if that has that such great potential, why is there the because if it's especially if you're able to take a cell from one's own body that can be used for correcting a circumstance or a situation that or a condition, you wouldn't have the rejection that you might have if you're trying to multiply some product from a foreign stem cell, which would require other kinds of medication for life or whatever in order to make that correction. Can you just elaborate on that a bit as to why there is a more enamored with the embryonic or that type of stem cell versus the adult or your own stem cell research for these correcting these conditions?
Madam Chair and Senators, you've actually raised 2 points, so if I could take them separately, I hope that'll be okay. First of all, there are different ways to create stem cells. However, in fact, to date, those other forms have not been as effective in creating specific types of cell lines as embryonic stem cells have. So whether they will in the future be able to do that is an interesting question. And in fact, it's one that we're addressing right now. We would not be able to address that because we couldn't do the comparative test in this state if this language passes. Secondly, with respect to rejection, Embryonic stem cells don't reject because those cells are not recognized as foreign by anybody, by an adult, by a child. And that is one of the features of that particular cell type that makes it interesting and potentially very effective.
I see Senator Bonoff has perhaps a follow-up, but I do want to remind committee members that this is the Finance Committee, and we certainly want to understand what we're passing, but this is an issue that was taken up in the Policy and Finance Higher Ed Committee, but we don't want to get too far off track. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the reminder, because, of course, that is where I was going, because I do feel pretty strongly about this. Just anecdotally, my cousin has just undergone stem cell transplant and down at the Mayo and is being watched so carefully for rejection and what that'll mean, you know, if that happens. And we should remember that under President Bush, we did have some pretty severe restrictions. And so I was told by Johns Hopkins doctor that, in fact, other countries are much farther ahead than we are because of those restrictions that have now been lifted. And so from the financial aspect alone, having our university at a competitive disadvantage in this area is significant, especially when we have stated that we have a commitment to identify the bioscience area as an area of growth. So I think this is the antithesis of that, and I am opposed to that. There was another thing you mentioned that I just wanted to say something about. I'm sure it'll come back to me. Thank you.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Friedman. With respect to this provision in the bill, is it a matter that you appreciate that there are many people who have a moral reluctance to the idea of creating and destroying or using embryos for some other purpose, no matter how beneficial that purpose might be? And does that have any bearing on whether or not public funds ought to be expended in a way that many people find morally objectionable?
Dr. Friedman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. Yes, I do actually do understand that, and I think it is a very strongly held belief, and I understand that completely. I think it was my job here to point out that that isn't the only moral imperative in this conversation. And for those of us, as I said, who have sat in front of families and said, we can't help your child anymore, that's a very strongly held belief.
Senator Goodwin.
Madam Chair and Dr. Friedman, I'm wondering if it would have been possible at all to even do in vitro fertilization without the similar type of research to what you may be doing now for other issues.
Dr. Friedman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually don't know the answer to that because it's actually a different, while some of the techniques are similar between in vitro fertilization and other forms of stem cell study, I think it's important to recognize that what's mentioned here is taking one cell that is enucleated, meaning the nucleus is removed, and putting the nuclear or what's called somatic material back into that cell so that there's a single site for all the DNA. That's obviously very different than in vitro fertilization, but fundamentally the underlying processes are quite similar.
Senator Goodwin,
Madam Chair,
we're supposed to be dealing
with. Okay, I'll get on financial. I'll get on financial stuff now. Dr. Friedman, I wonder, you said it would be like a $30 million cost to the university, or that you've already spent invested $30 million. Now, I know that the Mayo Clinic does similar research, mm-hmm. and I assume that there's private medical research firms that might be working on it in Minnesota. But I don't know that. But is there any way we can estimate, and I'm trying to do this to everybody, and I know you can't answer this for everybody else, but perhaps Senator Fischbach can. Is there any way we can anticipate what kind of job loss would result in Minnesota as a result of passing this legislation?
Dr. Friedman.
And you can talk about the university.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. We do know that in our own system, well over 120 or so individuals are involved in those labs, just in those labs, that are working on stem cells, are working with stem cells at the university. I can't, at least I can't speak to the larger impact.
Madam Chair, just one more thing, and this is personal, but without in vitro fertilization, I wouldn't have my great little grandbaby that I have. So I definitely believe that medical research is important, and it's important for the brother-in-law I lost to diabetes at a very early age and others in my family, too.
Senator Bonham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did remember the last piece that I couldn't get my thoughts together on, and that had to do with the impact of also blocking our access to the federal funds. Is that a change from the legislation that was previously passed and that you've referred to in 2008?
Senator Fischbach.
And Madam Chair, Senator Bonham, I don't have that language in front of me, but I believe it is.
Yeah, so Madam Chair, that's even a graver concern because there's a lot of access to grants and significant R&D money that our researchers at both the university and at Mayo, which we are so fortunate to have these flagship institutions in our state, and they could access these federal dollars, bring that here, you know, we could attract the top scientists in this field, which is, it seems to be at the crux of solving many of the challenging diseases that are in our midst today. And so to cut off access to that kind of federal dollars does not seem very smart from a financial perspective.
Senator Bonham. Mr. Bodden has looked that up
to see
what has been in previous law.
Madam Chair and members, I compared Section 10 with what was passed in 2009, which was Chapter 95, Article 1, Section 5. That restricted that the language there applied only to the appropriation made to the University of Minnesota for that biennium. And this language, as you can see, applies to all state funds, any federal funds received by the state, and I think it would apply to any state entity.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Dr. Friedman, is it possible to salvage this definition so that it would refer to only to what we normally would think of as cloning of a human being, reproducing a human being, rather than getting a definition that is so unclear that it could be construed to include stem cell research?
Dr. Friedman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. I would encourage a look at the California definitions and proposals. California, as you may know, has actually invested heavily in stem cell research and has very clearly made the point that it is not interested in cloning humans, but it is interested in stem cell research. So I would encourage that look. Yes, the answer to your question, I think, is yes.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Friedman. Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, when we were talking about Senator Fischbach's anti-cloning bill in Human Services Committee, we had a statement from the University of Minnesota, and they were very clear. They started out by saying, we have never done research on human cloning, we don't want to do research on human cloning, and we never will do research on human cloning. And yet, I'm kind of frustrated because the language here is about cloning, which, you know, we all kind of, Senator Rosen talked about, you know, how one of her bulls had been cloned and how creepy it was to see, you know, the three little clones, just like, I don't remember the guy, the bull's name, but anyway. But even though that's what everybody thinks of when we talk about human cloning, nobody's talked about cloning today. We've all talked about stem cell research. And so it's like a bait and switch. You know, what people think of that we're talking about prohibiting isn't what we're prohibiting at all, and that's not honest. And I'm very concerned about this. We have a wonderful land grant institution. We have private entities who are doing research that can save people's lives. And for us to step into that by saying we're prohibiting cloning, when that isn't what we're doing at all, at least based on all the conversations we've had since we started seeing these bills in the legislature, just is not honest, and it's not what we should be doing on behalf of the citizens that we represent here in Minnesota.
There's no further discussion on this issue. Thank you, Dr. Friedman.
Thank you.
And that's what I think about life.
Senator Fischbach?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know what your intention is. I mean, I sit on the committee, so I can make the motion if that's point.
I don't have anyone else down who asked to testify, but I do want to ask if there's anyone else in the audience who would like to testify. We did have testimony in the Higher Education Committee last night and yesterday, several meetings yesterday. So if there's no other questions or testifiers, you may make your motion. Senator Bana.
Madam Chair, I was hoping somebody else would because I didn't want to monopolize the conversation, but I am concerned about the deeper cut in this bill than the governor's proposal with regard to higher ed and the impact it's going to have on access to our young people. We referred briefly to the increase of students who need-based aid, given what's going on in the economy. We talk all of the time about the importance of making sure we have an educated workforce, that our children get to post-secondary education, and that they graduate. And yet, if they don't have the resources because we are limiting their ability to access need-based aid, we're not going in a direction that is going to get us where we have said we value and what we value. And so I'm concerned overall about this budget. The most I'm concerned with is that as well. So, Senator Fischbach, your thoughts about that and how we might make certain that every young person has the ability to attend post-secondary education.
And Madam Chair, members, I mean, we did try to meet our budget. We did meet our budget. Obviously, the governor's proposal is based on a completely different set of numbers, including a tax increase. And so we lived within our means, and I think that we did. You know, there are some reductions in what will be going to the systems, the U of M and to the MinSCU program. But we were able to put seven. I know doesn't make up the entire hole in the state grant program, but we were able to put, I believe it's 7.2 back into the state grant program, or maybe it's 7.4. 7.4. She remembers the numbers. So that we were able to try to help in that state grant program. So I think that we did find a decent balance. Yes, I understand that, no, we didn't fill the incomplete hole in the state grant program, but, you know, we changed the formula just a little bit so that it'll be pushed down into the lower income families to help those folks out. So hopefully we will be able to make the entire system work.
Senator Fischbach, I think it's important, Senator Higgins, to note that the base from last year for the state grant program stayed the same, and we added 7.4. Okay. And the projection was that there would need to be some more money because it was prorated because of the demand for the state grant program. Mm-hmm. So we have it may still have to be prorated. At least we'll know that in the first year. The problem we had in the last biennium is that everybody got the amount they had anticipated, and because it happened in the middle of the year, we realized there might be a shortfall. So they gave everybody what was anticipated the first year, and the second year, the pro rata amount was more significant. This year, they're going to try and balance that out much better. And as Senator Fischbach said, there really has been an effort and some language in here to make sure that the lowest income families still won't have to be prorated in the same fashion as the higher income families. And the students from higher income families actually get a very small amount of money, maybe $100 or $200 in grant money from the state, and those are the ones that may see a loss of their state grant. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Fischbach, was there any information given out in the Higher Education Budget Division about what programs the MNSCU or the University of Minnesota systems might have to eliminate as a result of this budget? I note there is some freeze language in here on tuition also, so I'm assuming, you know, there'd be some limit on the increase of tuition based on the language in the bill, and that the rest of the cut has to be made up by loss of programs. And I'm just wondering if you know what they would be and if we could find out what they would be.
Senator Fischbach.
And Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, both of the systems testified, I guess, last night, though the U of M didn't, but had been given the opportunity to. And I know that MNSCU indicated in particular, and if there is someone who wants to come up and join me, they may have a more detailed information. But I know that MNSCU has been working on that and looking campus by campus at the things that they may be, you know, that they may be facing, and they've been proactive in looking at what kind of programs, what they're going to do to save the money. At one point, and I don't know if I've got it, but there was something passed out regarding what for MNSCU, what each campus would see as a reduction in their money. And I don't remember. Actually, it was Senator Pappas who handed it out, so I don't know if I have it in my packet or not, but. So there was some discussion. I don't know if they ever gave us very specifics and said X, Y, and Z are going to be cut. I know that they, in particular with MNSCU, they are doing some reductions now. The St. Cloud State, the aviation program, is one of the ones that people hear a lot about.
Yes, Senator Berglund, they did say that they were trying to keep an aviation program in the state. So there is one, but St. Cloud will be cut. They're reducing staff, which they have a concern will reduce course offerings for students, and they may have a little harder time getting the courses that they want when they want them. But they weren't real specific. They did say at this point they do not have plans to close any campuses for MNSCU, and Board of Trustees will work on dealing with the cuts. So did you have another question?
Well, I'm gathering the answer is that they thought there might be some programs that would be cut, but we don't know for sure what they would be. Is that?
That's correct. They didn't specify.
Madam Chair, I would agree with that because they didn't give us real specifics.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair,
Just concerned that we're capping tuition and we're cutting, what did you say, how many hundreds of millions out of this budget?
411.
And, you know, in MNSCU, you know, there's kind of two ways you get money. It's from state financing and tuition. And that just makes a real train wreck. And I suspect there will be a lot of people who lose their jobs over this budget. This budget is $2.5 billion. That's the smallest amount we have invested in higher education since the first budget you and I did, Senator. The 1998-1999 budget.
99.
And the world has changed. You know, you could buy a car, a pretty decent car, for $14,000 then. Now it's double that. But we're rolling back our funding for higher ed back to that that much smaller amount. And That's very concerning. We talk about ourselves as the brain power state. We believe in education. We know that the future is the student. The future for our state is the students that we can educate, and someday they're going to take care of all of us. And here we're taking away the opportunity for a lot of those young folks to have that college education and go on to great jobs and do great research or run a company or whatever. And I'm kind of sad about this.
Senator Berkley.
Madam Chair, the reason I asked my question is because it only stands to reason in my mind that there will be either substantial reductions in course offerings for some subjects or complete elimination of some course offerings. And, you know, when this is all said and done and the legislature goes home, you know, the local colleges or the Minsky system themselves or the university hears about legislators being upset that programs got closed. And you know, it's like, well, I didn't think you were going to close that program. I guess I thought it would be somebody else's program. I don't know. And, of course, I am, you know, I mean, I'll just say up front, I am concerned about science programs that lead to medical careers. I am concerned about nursing programs. I am concerned about laboratory technology programs because if we don't have enough of those kind of workers, then our healthcare costs go up. And so, but, you know, so I guess what I am simply requesting of the systems is that if you see that we are going to end up having fewer offerings or closing of any programs that affect the ability to produce the medical personnel that we need, I would like to hear about it now, not later.
And Senator Berglund, they didn't mention specifics, but I know that Minsky and the U of M both have been focusing heavily on the STEM courses and know that there's a job market for those that probably exceeds all others, and I think that they know that that needs to be a priority. I think their boards understand that, and I hope that they would continue to move in that direction. We've built a lot of new laboratories in science facilities, mainly because of their expansion in those areas, and I don't think that they'd be ready to roll back on those programs.
Madam Chair, I hope not, but, you know, those kind of courses cost more. So when you're getting your funding cut, when you have a limit on tuition, you know, it wouldn't be a rocket scientist who would say, well, maybe we should look at some of our most expensive courses.
Madam Chair.
Senator Langsett.
Well, Madam Chair, I remember several years ago, and, you know, Minnesota's economy has always sort of led the Midwest, except for a couple of years recently. Led the Midwest in economic growth, and the Wisconsin legislature was in session, and they were trying to figure out why Minnesota had a higher economic growth than Wisconsin. And they studied it, and they come up with a conclusion that Minnesota had a better educated, better trained workforce. And here what we've been doing these last few years is just cut on the very things we're talking about that are going to be needed in the future. I mean, I just had a high school education, but when I come out of high school, if you're willing to work, you could do fine. But in the future, most of our young people are going to have to be educated and trained. And here we just come in and cut. You know, I remember in 98, we cut taxes a couple of billion dollars. We can't get that back. But we're talking about jobs and economy, and I think this bill, more than any bill we'll be passing in the next few days, is going to do more to harm our jobs and our economy in the future than anything else that we're going to do. But it's going to happen. You know, you got the votes. Go ahead and vote for it. But boy, I've seen what has happened to tuitions and the cuts. I was just talking to the president of the Minnesota State University of Moorhead yesterday, and she was talking about, well, if we could get by with a 10% cut and a 5% tuition, she could make it work. But otherwise, there's going to be some big layoffs and so on. But that doesn't seem to matter in this whole mode we're in now. So I'm going to vote against the bill, and I hope that common sense prevails, because I don't think this is common sense at all.
Senator Fischbach?
Madam Chair, I'll renew my motion that Senate File 924 be recommended to pass and move to the floor. I believe we go to the floor.
Right, it does go to the floor. Senator Fischbach moves that Senate File 924 be recommended to pass and move to the floor on that motion. All
roll
in favor?
Roll call, please.
Roll call has been requested.
Senator Berglund?
No.
Senator Bonhoff?
No.
Senator Fischbach?
Yes.
Senator Goodwin?
No.
Senator Hahn?
Yes.
Senator Higgins?
No.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yes.
I'm having a real
Senator Langseth?
No.
Senator Magnus?
Yes.
Senator Newman?
Yes.
Senator Nienau?
Yep.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Perry?
Yes.
Chair Roebling?
Yes. On a vote of 9-5, the motion does prevail. The bill is approved and will be moved to the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
That's all we have for today. Tomorrow morning we come back at 8:30 again. Or wait. We have.
Yeah. Okay.
We come back for caucus at 8:30. I don't know about the Democrats, but we will be on the floor at 9, and then we hope to be back in committee around 10 o'clock. And we will be doing the environments, Senator Ingebrigtsen's bill, commerce, and energy. And and judiciary.
Oh,
wow. I forgot about that. But we will be compiling three of those bills into one big bill in order to conference it with the House. The other three besides judiciary. So that will be moving out as a block in the end. And then we'll add different articles to it. Senator Hahn?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to remind the Chair that I think there are five members of this committee that are also on the Health and Human Services Committee. We are also meeting tomorrow. So we are going to have to coordinate, when we have votes and so forth. And so I just want to call that to your attention so we can try to do the best we can.
We'll definitely try to make sure that members are here for votes, right. Especially any of the
time. What time are we meeting tomorrow?
Oh, my. And Senator Olson has the education bill up before taxes. So, with no further business for today, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you, members.
I didn't want to come here. That's what Marianne, I did speak to Senator Kramer about our.